But in studio, my special guest today is Cormac Moore, historian in residence with Dublin City Libraries, and we're going to talk about the partition in Ireland. Good afternoon, Cormac.
Good afternoon,
how are you?
Noel.
Okay, if you just pull that mic down a little bit in front of you, that's it. So how's things going, all right?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Very good.
Okay, now the partition of Ireland, this was controversial to say the least.
Yeah,
that's putting it very, 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 very mildly.
Very mildly, yes. Well, it is, you would say that, but in all of this decade of commemorations, who really talks about partition, you know? And it is the biggest legacy issue of this decade, you know, the biggest headache, I suppose, or issue that has come out of the decorations is that this country is now partitioned.
And isn't it funny I don't mean to interrupt you, but it just occurs to me as well, that the only time it's mentioned, it's in relation to Michael Collins getting shot. Like, they'll always say, well, that's why he was shot. Even said it himself, that's the death of me and all.
Well, the biggest problem with the treaty wasn't Northern Ireland or Ulster, you know, it was actually to do with you know, the oath and the loyalty to the crown. That was the biggest disagreement. The mm-hmm. Civil War, primarily in the south, didn't happen because of partition. Like, if you look at the basically, they actually did believe this boundary commission. So with the Anglo-Irish treaty in December 1921, Arthur Griffith agreed he wouldn't disagree with the British if they agreed to a boundary commission. So the whole purpose of the boundary commission was because Northern Ireland had been in existence for about 6 months once the treaty was signed. So it was almost a fait accompli at that stage. You know, it was operating, had government departments, it was in the process of getting a judiciary, a police force. You know, so it was already there by the time the treaty was signed. But Griffith agreed that if you got a boundary commission, which would actually determine the full size of the actual border, he'd be happy with that. Because nationalists very naively thought that huge, you know, areas were going to be transferred to the Irish Free State. They had thought all of Tyrone, all of Fermanagh, because they had mm-hmm. Catholic majorities. They thought Derry City. They had thought Newry. They thought lots of areas of South Armagh. So they thought that Northern Ireland was going to be left as a rump state. But if they really looked at the wording of the treaty, it was very vague. It was saying, you know, depending on circumstances to do with economic, social, reasons, the border would be determined. So that could have been interpreted anyway. It was. And as it transpired with the Boundary Commission findings in 25, there was going to be a small movement of areas from the Northern Ireland to the south. But there was also going to be areas, for example, in Donegal, that were going to be moved to Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. So the Free State government says, this is embarrassing, let's bury this report, let's just leave it the way it was. And now that's what we have.
Okay,
we have,
the precursor to all this, who was involved in the talks and all that, when you're talking about the actual partition and how they decided on who, where and when?
Yeah,
was it done very quickly?
It's a very complicated process. The Home Rule kind of question, you know, the Irish question, as it's been called, mm-hmm. kind of came up with Gladstone and, you know, obviously Parnell and in the first Home Rule Bill in 1886. Ulster wasn't that big an issue there, but it was. There was a lot of opposition from Ulster Unionists. They became louder in 1893, but it wasn't a big issue then because both of those Home Rule bills were defeated in normal parliamentary means. The House of Commons in 1886, the House of Lords in 1893. But by 1912, the Third Home Rule Bill was going to be passed and the House of Lords lost its veto. So it was going to come into law. That's when Ulster really got angry and Ulster really mobilised and threatened a civil war with the support of the Conservative Party in Britain. Wow. And it was at that time, the whole kind of language became, we have to do something about Ulster. We have to exclude Ulster. How much of Ulster is it? 9 counties, 4 counties, 6 counties? So that was the whole debate about the Irish question pretty much from 1912 onwards. After the war, Ireland had changed drastically in that the Irish Party had lost all of its power. You know, in the 1918 general election, they went from the dominant party to having just 6 seats. Sinn Féin were the main nationalist party. They refused to take their seats in Westminster. So you had no nationalist representation in Westminster. And it was then after that it was decided to bring in the Government of Ireland Act, which was a unionist bill, basically. It was a committee chaired by a unionist called Walter Long. And they came up with this idea of let's partition Ireland. And a lot of unionists didn't want to partition either. They wanted Ulster or whatever counties in Ulster to remain part of Britain. They wanted to retain the same status. they did not want to self-govern. They did not want to have their own parliament, their own government. But they soon realised that actually this is a better deal.
Well, if Sinn Féin had have stayed, elected representatives, if they had I can understand, but if they had have attended parliament and maybe had made big representations, do you think maybe the outcome might have been different?
It's a good question. We don't know. Sinn Féin made that reason and they were very vocal about it and still are very vocal about it, and they're entitled to make that decision to be abstained from Westminster. People vote for them on that basis, that they know they're going to abstain from Westminster. And they did it because there was good justification for abstaining from Westminster as well, because if you look at the Irish Party, like, their whole language and their whole kind of agreements kept on changing. It kept on. So first of all, when this whole idea of excluding Ulster came up, say realistically 1912, there was no, the British Prime Minister Herbert Asquith said not a chance of excluding Ulster. All of Ireland is going to be included in this bill. And there was an amendment to exclude Ulster, which was heavily defeated. But then by 1914, the Liberals had changed, particularly under leadership of Lloyd George and Winston Churchill. They said, look, let's exclude Ulster temporarily. And Redmond signed up to that. But then an agreement, after the Rising, an agreement was attempted by Lloyd George. And he said to the Unionists that was going to be permanent, and he said to the Nationalists it was going to be temporary.
Okay.
And then it was realised, actually, it is going to be it is actually going to be permanent. Every time the Nationalists, in the guise of the Irish Party, agreed something with the British kept on changing it. The biggest problem was that in British politics at the time, the Conservative Party, after the 1918 general election, became by far the biggest party. The Conservative Party is known as the Conservative and Unionist Party. So they were all Unionists, particularly their leader, Andrew Bonar Law. He was vehemently opposed to any home rule, and he did not want Ulster in particular to be included in a Dublin Parliament. So even if Sinn Féin were in Westminster, there's very little say they would have had. And even the Liberals, under Lloyd George, they were not big converts to home rule, even though they supported the bill. They did for practical reasons, for the votes in the parliament. But they were not like Gladstone, who was on a moral mission to bring in home rule. The Liberals of 1912 to 1918 and so on, they were not fans of home rule, really. So Sinn Féin probably, you could see why they didn't attend Westminster. But they definitely could have made amendments to the bill. They definitely could have had an input into the bill, because the Walter Long's committee actually said we're going to partition all of Ulster. So they would have had their own. So that included Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. But it was actually the Ulster Union said, no, we don't want 9 counties because it's almost half and half, Catholics and Protestants. We just want 6 counties. That'll give us a Protestant state. So the British government decided to consent to that.
Okay.
And that's what happened.
But the only reason I mentioned about Sinn Féin and that as well is, even coming up to today, we know how ignorant the majority of English people are about Ireland and what goes on and the history of it.
Yeah.
And even if they hadn't had much clout, as I say, maybe they could have put across more of actually to the people what was going on. Of course, they didn't televise it at that time, but I'm sure there was written reports.
Newspapers are obviously very, very popular at the time. But honestly, the British public were sick of Ireland at that stage. They wanted rid of it. So did the British government. They just wanted they were so sick of Ireland dominating British politics. And it had dominated it for decades.
Really?
The Irish question had. This whole, it ruined the Liberal Party, ultimately. It was the reason, primary reason why the Liberal Party declined so drastically was because of its support for home rule.
Looks like it might ruin Theresa May now.
Yeah, well, it could. The reason why we're talking about partition so much now is because of Brexit. It really does put the Irish border into context. But I think a lot of people in Ireland don't really understand partition either. We don't talk about it much. Even historically, if you look at the history books on Ireland, you're two options. If you're an Ulster historian, you write about a Northern Ireland state. You talk about the founding of Northern Ireland state and so on. But you move away from the south. And you just from 1921, you talk about the history of Northern Ireland state. If you're a Southern historian, you tend to have a little bit about the founding of Northern Ireland, and then let's move on to the founding of the Irish Free State and the history of that. So there's very little a double history, of the two Irelands since 1921, and we kind of just went. They were partitioned. That was it. Move on. Let's forget about the fact that this whole partition issue has dominated politics, society within not just the border counties but the whole country for the last 100 years.
And my opening statement shows you little I know about it as well.
With Michael Collins.
Yeah,
No, yeah, because like people did use it in the Civil War, but the reality is, as I was saying, that all kind of strains of the Sinn Féin supported this boundary commission idea. Even if you look at De Valera's document number 2, that was his kind of his opposition to the treaty was going to be replaced by his document number 2. It had the very same policies on the north, on partition, as what was signed in the treaty. They didn't have any divergence at all. So you know, they actually believed this boundary commission was this, you know, was going to save everything and bring back a united Ireland. Sinn Féin had no policy really on Ulster. They honestly thought that if England were gone, the Ulster Unionists would come, you know, jumping and skipping to a united Ireland. Like, it's so naive to think that these Ulster Unionists, they were no way going to openly embrace the united Ireland if the British came. The Sinn Féin genuinely believed that. They believed the British were the sole problem, that they were the ones, once they left, Unionists would fold and realise that they were all Irishmen and all very happy to comply with each other.
So they were naive in their own way.
Sinn Féin had a terrible policy on the north, and they were actually very weak in the north as well, electorally as well. If you look compared to other parts of Ireland, they absolutely walked aboard practically in all of the provinces except for Ulster, where they almost shared the same amount of seats with the Irish Party. Because first of all, they weren't organised up there. The Irish Party were very well organised up there with a leader like Joseph Devlin, who was far more like De Valera ran against Devlin. In Belfast, West Belfast Falls district in the 1918 general election, and Devlin easily defeated him. Now, De Valera did win 2 seats in that election, but still, it just shows that the Sinn Féin were very weak on the north, and they had no real policy on it. They had no real understanding of Ulster Unionists and their opposition. They didn't try to understand them, they didn't try to talk to them, and you know, that's why they were so so weak on that issue.
Yes, yeah. Okay, did you think it'd ever go?
Partition, we know now obviously that the numbers are definitely it's often asked, you know, is a unionist a Protestant, or say if it's a Protestant unionist, is a Catholic a nationalist? Not necessarily, but there is a tendency, there is definitely a clear link between Protestants being unionists and Catholics being nationalists. There's actually a very interesting report in the first partition election, first Northern Ireland election of May 1921. It literally, almost to a 1 percentage point, like all of the Protestants voted for unionists and all of the Catholics voted for nationalists, which is extraordinary. You know, pretty much there was no divergence I think now that there definitely seems to be more Catholics, outgrowing Protestants. And you even look at the electoral support of the nationalist parties in the north. It definitely seems there's a trend moving away towards unionism and going towards nationalism. But under the Good Friday Agreement, there has to be consent if there is to be united Ireland. And there certainly won't be consent within the unionist community for a long time.
It's a strange situation, all right, because, I mean, everyone's just get together and forget about politics and just get into just with the people themselves and what's best for everybody.
One thing I'm talking about is actually, or research at the moment, is even though Ireland was divided under political lines, most bodies that were all Ireland bodies before partition remained all Ireland bodies, like most sports, like rugby, cricket, hockey, golf. They're still all Ireland bodies. All the churches, like the Catholic Church, the Church of Ireland, all the Protestant churches, they're all Ireland bodies. Loads of societies, loads of volunteer organisations. They said, forget about a border, which is unusual. Like, if you look at internationally, where there has been divided countries, all of the other kind of the kind of societies, the sporting organisations, the different bodies, they divided along.
And the police seem to be getting in that vogue as well.
Well, policing is divided.
Yeah, is that true? Oh, it's still. They sort of liaison quite a lot.
They do now.
Even that's changed.
Well, I'm researching on sporting aspect and boxing. Boxing, the Irish Amateur Boxing Association remained an all-Ireland body and had a very strong kind of military and security elements to it. So they had a Garda, team, and they had a RUC team, and they used to travel, across the border, fighting, competing in competitions against each other.
We could do with the unification of the football now, could we?
that is obviously one of my books is the Irish Soccer Split. So We know all about the Irish football scenario. Yes.
It's funny, I was reading somewhere during the week, I was just writing it down here just to remind me to say it to you, that the lines between patriotism and nationalism have become rather blurred to an extent.
Yeah,
Two different things.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Put them in
the
same boat, but they're completely two different things, nationalism and patriotism. Maybe that's something people can ponder as well. Anything else to do with the partition that you need to get out there?
Got so much. I could go on all day in old times. Okay. You know, it's a big topic. But
it certainly is. It certainly is. Okay, any talks coming up for yourself, Cormac?
Yeah, I'm speaking to a number of men sheds. I'm speaking about Edge Hardware next week with the men sheds. I'm speaking with Marino. That's next week. And then the following week, I'm at Rahini Men Sheds. I speak about the War of Independence. So yeah, they're the primary talks at the moment. Coming up. Okay. And I'm actually, and the Cúla Cártaín History Society, which I'm involved in, we're having a talk next Thursday in Parnell's. So it's going to be I'll be talking about Spanish flu, and then there'll be another talk on.
What time is that in Parnell's?
It's 6:30 or 7. I think it's 6:30.
Okay.
In Parnell's GA Club, yeah.
Next Thursday.
Yeah, so look at the Cúla Cártaín Twitter, Facebook, website, and the Times.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about for indeed? Of course, they'd be. I mean, no, it's not open in the Marina or Rahini, because that'd be just for the men sheds anyway.
Well, I know they're always looking for members. So if you're a man. Yeah. And you're from a certain age group, perhaps. I don't know. I don't know actually what the criteria is to be to be a member. They're fantastic. I don't know.
Oh, they're
great.
I've interviewed many of them. Yeah, I'm just saying in case anybody wanted to go.
Yeah, if you're from Marino or Rahini, you know, look them up. You know, they're or even Hugh Flanagan organizing. Hugh Flanagan works in the community officer in Dublin City here. He's based in this building.
Okay.
And he's very involved in all of those men sheds. But yeah, they're always open to have a. To members and to come along.
If you just want to hear those talks.
But exactly, then, exactly. Yes.
One we're sure of anyway is next Thursday in Parnell's in Coolock there, 6:30. Anyway, Cormac, always great talking to you, and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Noel.
Thank you very much. And that's Cormac Moore, historian and resident of Dublin City Libraries and from the North Central area. Thank you.